This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Group is Train, the song is Soul Sister, and speaking of sisters, my older sister, Margaret Ann McNamara, known as Peggy to everybody, joins the program for the first time. Peggy, have you ever been on my show before?
Yeah, a long time ago, in North Dakota.
My big sister, Peggy. For those people who listen, you've heard me refer to Peggy as the toughest person I know, and she is, in fact, that. So, it's kind of a first. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to talk about domestic violence today. We're going to talk about living with trauma today. And so before we do that, though, we got to learn a little bit about Peggy. So, Peggy, born and raised where?
Sacramento, California.
All right. And grew up, and what did you grew up, went to Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, Bishop and Oak High School. You got to the end of high school, and what did you want to be? What did you want to do in life? Where'd you go? What'd you do?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I had no idea. But I went to a few years of college and wound up back home and decided to go to court reporting school.
Went to San Diego State University, home of the Aztecs.
Yes. Yeah. For one semester. And I had just too much fun at the beach. I didn't go to school.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So you didn't go to class?
Well, that's a long story, but I had that Firebird. Remember my red Firebird?
Oh, my God. Of course I do.
Make the Firebird payment. So I got a job, and my job was in the day. And so I had to go. Most of my classes were late afternoon and night classes, and just didn't happen for me.
Really?
So I was at the beach instead.
Nice.
But it was a good move because I came back to Sacramento and got a job as a secretary, but did a little research and went to court reporting school, which was not an easy task. Worked my way through school, worked at the Department of Justice on swing shifts, like we work in the evening, go to school full time in the day, and I accomplished that mission.
Okay, so
became a court reporter.
You became a court reporter. Now, what year is this?
1986.
That was the year the Boston Red Sox lost to the New York Mets. Did you know that?
Yes, I do.
Mm, all right. Just wondering.
Never have to remind me of that.
Just wondered. How would you describe that experience in your life?
What, the World Fairy?
Yes.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. Right.
You know, some people say it's just a game, but to us it wasn't a game. It was our life. It was our dad. You know, that could have been his greatest moment. It was still a great moment because he got there. But it was heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. Were you still in New York when it happened, or had you gone home?
No, I had gone back to Boston because I didn't have a stadium anymore. So I went back to Boston. Well, after the last, you know, little set of games that was at Boston, I go back to New York. I stayed at Dad's house in Boston. I was watching it on TV.
My God. That was actually a good call because if anything like that, I'll offer people some advice. If anything like that ever happens to you in your life, you want it to happen like in Minnesota or Kansas City where the people are just not
New York City.
Yeah, nice Midwestern people, not New York City. Come on. It was awful. It was absolutely positively awful. So, are you single? Are you going out with anybody? What are you doing socially?
I was living with my boyfriend at the time, who I ended up marrying.
Okay. So you guys get married. When did you get married?
I don't even know. It was after Tori was born. Tori was born in 1990. So shortly thereafter.
Okay, so you're living with your boyfriend.
We went to Lake Tahoe. We just went to Lake Tahoe to get married in a chapel. No big wedding or anything.
Okay, so you do that. And do you want to mention his name? Do you not like saying his name?
No, I don't.
Okay, all right. You have your first baby. And tell us about Tori.
Tori?
Yes.
He's my oldest son. He's adorable. He's funny, smart. I only knew him for 6 years, though. So.
All right. So you only knew him for 6 years, and then you have a second baby. Tell us about
Tyler.
Tyler. The maniac?
No, Tyler was not a maniac. Tyler was kind of shy. Tyler was the one that liked to play with Barbie. My Barbie. My collectible Barbie. So I bought him a Ken doll. And he used to ride through the kitchen in a Barbie convertible with Ken and Barbie. And they had a boat. And he loved to play with his people. That's what he called it.
His people. How did you save all that Barbie stuff? Where did it come from?
I started collecting it.
When?
Collecting Barbies.
When
he started playing with them, I started buying him, you know, all the a boat, a car, everything Barbie needed. Family, sisters, brothers.
It is funny, this story that we're over at Peggy's house, and this is after the boys were already gone, and Peggy said, well, if you want to play with all my Barbie stuff, it's fine. And John and Patrick look at me, and I'm like, whatever, whatever you want to do. And then later on, they asked, like, Dad, like, why does Aunt Peggy have all the Barbie stuff? If she had two boys. I'm like, I don't know.
Well, you know what? I bought a most of that stuff after they were passed away. I just kept collecting. I bought a Barbie house, and I bought that dog that I gave to Catherine. What was he called? I forgot his name.
I remember?
He barked, and he did this little thing. I was kind of crazy during those years after they passed away, and so I started collecting Barbie stuff.
All right. Talk to us. So you're a mom. Yeah, you have two kids. They're 2 years apart. You're busy.
I'm working for a federal judge now. I've worked myself up the ranks to a federal judge.
So you're as a court, you're and his
for the federal court.
So you're his court reporter, essentially. Yes.
Yes.
All right, so you have a good job. You have two babies, and now Tori goes to school, and And so life's going, but you, there's an incident in your life where your husband was arrested.
There was.
Okay. Talk about that. What happened?
I don't know about that.
What? Oh. You said there was, not there was. Okay, so.
What?
So, there was an incident that he hit you. Yes?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So, talk
basically,
about that.
Basically, well, I had a miscarriage, actually, and was very hormonal and went out, decided to go to the movies with a friend of mine, girlfriend. And he worked nights. He worked at a bakery. So, we ended up not going to the movies. We ended up going for drinks, and I got kind of wasted and called him for a ride. I didn't want to drive. And he pulled up in the parking lot, and I got in the car and he beat the shit out of me all the way home. So in the morning, I got up and I left, and I went to the doctor, and I had him take pictures and document it. And then I went to our cousin's house, who was a cop with a big black eye. He took one look at me and said, what happened? And they went to the apartment. And they arrested him.
And then what happened? So does he go to trial? Does what? How does that work?
No.
How did that work in California at the time? He gets arrested, then what? Because a lot of states, when somebody gets arrested, at that point, the state is now the person filing charges, and the charges cannot be withdrawn because of the tendency.
Exactly.
Because of the tendency of domestic violence victims to get afraid and to withdraw the charges because they don't want something worse to happen.
That's exactly what I did.
What?
I called the DA and I asked him what was happening with this case, and I asked them to drop the charges.
Why?
Because his mom asked me to do that. And at the time, I worked in the court system, and it was embarrassing, and everything seemed to be okay. We were back together. That was before we had kids or anything.
Okay.
When that happened. Way before. So, things were going good, so I didn't want my business out there. So I did it, and they dropped it.
Okay.
They dropped the charges. He was never charged with anything.
Okay. What, out of that, do you learn anything out of that?
I learned to be scared of him.
How, did that happen again?
Not like that, no. But he had a raging temper. He could go from, you know, sitting there watching a basketball game to someone spills milk and all hell breaks loose, you know. And so I was constantly trying to buffer him between the kids, but he was never abusive towards them, ever.
Nice.
He was a good dad as far as that goes. But
and
he wasn't a very good husband.
So he's, and part of one of the other pieces is that he was, do I have this part wrong, that he was like volunteer of the year at the elementary school or got some?
You know, I don't remember that.
Okay.
But I do know that because I worked full time and he was on workers' comp at the time. He had something in the bakery he was allergic to and he was breaking out in hives. So he was off work. So he was doing all this stuff at the school and he was active and helping. Just like if I wasn't working, I would be at school. He was up at the school all the time.
All right, and so as the date approaches where he kills Tori and Tyler, what's going on in his life? Did you know? Tell us about your marriage.
It was
obviously
going very bad. It was going south fast. I got this great job. And I've worked so hard for school. The kids were doing great. But he was going downhill. And there's several people who said to me that they thought he might be bipolar. Back then, that was 1996, no one heard of bipolar. They didn't know what it was. But he wasn't coming home at night. I never knew what he was. I think he had a girlfriend or several. He would come be gone 2, 3, 4 days at a time with no explanation. And if I asked, I was the one that was wrong. There'd be a big blow up. So I just decided I got to get out of this. So I was trying to push the subject nicely, like, you know, this isn't working and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, I just need to give him a workers' comp. Because if I accused him of anything, being out all night or what you're up to, it was just, I couldn't take the ensuing argument and rage, and it would always turn out to be my fault. I didn't want the kids being subjected to that, and I hated it. So I just made the decision on my own to leave. And I told him I was going to leave. And he said, if you leave me, I will kill both those kids and kill myself and leave you here to suffer. So that scared me, because he had a gun. So I was really, really scared. And I reached out to different people, his parents, my parents, friends, co-workers, and I was telling everyone, do you know what he said? He threatened to kill my kids and kill himself. And everyone I spoke to said, oh, he would never do that. He's just trying to scare you. He needs to just get it together and get out of there with those kids, and everything will be okay. But that's not the way it happened. So without going into too much detail, one night...
Hold on. Why didn't you... I want to ask you this in public, so why didn't you call me?
I have no idea. I don't even know where you were, where you were at in your life. You were in San Diego, you said. You had your own little family, your own little kids. I didn't know. Well, what could you have done? Peggy's, you know, having problems with her husband again. Oh, well, that's how I felt. That's maybe not what would have happened, but that's how I felt.
But no, so this happens in September of 1996. In November.
October.
In a year previously at Thanksgiving, Peggy came down to San Diego. And I
had the kids.
Yeah, and him.
And my husband.
I had never met him. And because of the first incident. And I didn't want to meet him. And so Peggy got me on the phone, and she said, Michael, please, can we just get beyond this? And I said, okay. And she said, we'd love to come down for Thanksgiving, and, can you be nice to him? And I said, yeah, absolutely, I will, if that's what you want me to do. And so we had a wonderful time at Thanksgiving. And in San Diego, and I don't know, there's 5 kids in the house, my Susan and my 3 kids, and Peggy's 2 kids, and he was interested in computers, and I was messing with computers, so we talked about computers a bunch while he was there. And I just, my lament, Peggy, is I wish you would have called. Because,
well, I wish I would have done a lot of things.
Yeah, I know. I'm not. Because I don't understand, honestly, I don't understand how somebody would hear that and not take it seriously from somebody who owns a gun and who's already beaten you. So can you describe when he threatens you, my understanding is that when you told him, he actually went and got the gun out of the bedroom when he told this to you?
Well, which time?
The time that when you told him that things weren't working out and you thought you guys should split, and he threatened to kill the kids and kill himself, that he went and got a gun. Is that not?
Yep, and I talked him down.
Okay, so you guys are sitting on the couch or something like that, and he went and got the gun, and you talked him down. Explain that.
I got him to sit on the couch. You know, Michael, these memories are really fuzzy because post-traumatic stress disorder is trying to block them out.
Uh-huh.
But I just begged him, crying, to please go see your kids. You love them. I'm never going to keep them from you. I would never. You'll still be their dad. You'll still be able to see them. And I actually had to grab his hand with the gun in it and Kate put it down on the lap and get the gun out of his hand. And he backed off. But 2 weeks later, story didn't happen that way.
Okay. The events of that day are he comes home after staying, after being out all night, yes?
Maybe one or two nights, I don't know. And I just made up my mind. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm tired of being scared of him. I'm just going to let him know this is what I'm doing. I don't care what you say. And then, so he came in the door that morning. And he's like, why aren't you getting ready for work? I said, I'm not going to work. He said, why not? I said, because I'm going to find a place for me and the boys. And see, it's fuzzy now because we got into a physical altercation. I know we kind of struggled. He kind of slammed me up against the wall. I had a black eye at the kid's funeral, but I just don't remember all of the events. Oh, I know. After he hit me or pushed me or shoved me, I got the phone, and I got the phone first, and I started to call. I called 911, and he grabbed me, and he reached that phone. He threw the phone across the room, hung it up, and then we tussled some more because I was trying to get the phone back, and he left the room. He walked out of the room. The kids were asleep in my bed. When I came home. Then when I went to grab the phone again to get 911, he walked to the back of the house and came walking back the other way, and he went in the bedroom, and I was begging the 911 operator to please turn someone over that he had a gun. And she said, well, I need to know his name. I said his name. She goes, what's his last name? And it was just dead silence in the house, and I knew he was listening to every word I said. And I said, why do I have to tell you his last name? I gave the address. I said, please just come. He's got a gun. He's going to kill my kids and kill me. And he burst up. And then I heard the first shot. So then I ran to the bedroom. While I was running, I heard the second shot. And I'm still on the phone with the 911 operator, and I ran in the bedroom to see him put the gun in his mouth and put his head up. And my children were laying on the floor with their little brains coming out, and I couldn't do anything but stand there and scream. And that is when my nightmare began.
So,
hello?
No, I'm listening.
So then it's very fuzzy for me because I went into shock.
Right.
But I know that the fire department was the first, and then his mom came. I don't know how that, I might have called her. After I got a solid 911, it seemed like it took them forever to get there. I was just running around the house. So I might have called his mom. They all show up. TV cameras are outside. And they just put me in the back of the police car. And they took me down to a police station. And from there, it was like people just came to my rescue and were there for me. I had several friends that were judges at the courthouse that canceled their court and came to me and just surrounded me with lots of love. But there's no words to describe that feeling of losing your children and seeing their heads blown off like that by their own father. And there's a lot of guilt that goes with it, like, what did I do wrong? Why, you asked me, why didn't I call you? I wish I had called you. I wish I had reached out to some of these domestic violence resources. There's many more of them now than there are then, but I, you know, I guess it's old school, kind of don't want everyone to know your business. It's not that bad. It's going to be okay. He's a good guy, but I was terrified of him. So my advice to anybody in that situation, domestic violence, if you're afraid of the person you live with, of the father of your children, or even just your husband, get away. Don't think about it twice. Reach out to anybody and everybody you can and get help, because it's just, I've spent the last 24 years, just thinking about what I could have done different, how I could have made it different. And sometimes I hate myself for it, and it's hard to live with.
Have you ever wanted to kill yourself?
Yes, many times.
Why didn't you?
Because one phone call I got after it happened, and I was at a friend's house, a judge friend of mine just took me to a home and kept me there safe until mom and dad got there, and we got there. And they brought me the phone. They said, it's your brother. And you were so upset. You were almost hysterical. You were crying, and you said, can you listen to me? Listen to me. Listen to me. You can't let him win. He tried to kill you without pointing the gun at you because he's a coward. And you have to live your life the best life you can for your boys and to not let him win. And I'll never forget those words. So I saw the habit that said that reached on every single member of our family. I'm talking, you know, we have 29 cousins stretching out from here to up to Washington. Every single one of them was there. All the people from my jobs were there. I mean, the outpouring of strength and support. I could never, ever break those people's hearts again by doing, taking my own life. I would kill, it would just destroy people. You know, and then there was a point in my life, probably 10 years into it, where I wasn't thinking about committing suicide, but I was going to kill myself non-intentionally, just by running myself to the ground, by drinking and using drugs, recreational drugs, and I would have lost my mind and probably killed myself that way, but I rescued myself from that path. My sister helped me, Susan. She came and said, come on, you, I want you to move to Indiana. And I was like, why would I do that?
Exactly. Indiana, are you kidding me?
But
bunch of huckleberries back there.
Well, I thought, why not? Then I said, why? Why would I do that? Then I said, why not? You know, close mom lives there, dad lives in Tennessee, a 4-hour drive. She has 4 beautiful children. The youngest one at the time was like in first grade, and the oldest one was like in the 8th grade. So I sold my house and I left. And even though I didn't love Indiana, it was the best thing I could have done for myself. because I went somewhere where no one knew me, and I healed.
You and I, when I got back from Afghanistan in 2010, we were up in Seattle, and we were going someplace. And you looked at me and
you were taking me back to Edith Congo.
You looked at me and said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "Yeah." And you said, "I want to kill myself. But I don't want to do it with a gun because I'm afraid of guns. And I think if I, like, used any drugs, I'd screw it up and then everybody would be mad at me." I don't know.
Well, or just screw it up and be in a hospital bed for the rest of your life, or a vegetable or something. It's like, you know, my luck, I tried to kill myself and wouldn't die.
And so what kept you from doing that? And I told you, I said, look, nobody that knows you would say anything bad about you because, look, I mean, I've been to Iraq twice and Afghanistan once, and nobody I know lives with the pain that you live with. And so nobody would say a bad word about you. And then we talked about, you know, first of all, Peggy is, she's a good time when you're around her. She's no stranger to a good time. She likes to have fun. My kids, love her. She competes with my youngest sister, Susan, for the world's funniest aunt. But they love, going up. In fact, my daughters are pissed at you because they wanted to come see you a couple weeks ago.
I know.
They were pissed. They're like, Peggy said she's going to be too busy. And I'm like, whoa, what's up with that? They're like, I know. What's wrong with her? I'm like, made her mad. But,
I wasn't mad. I felt really terrible about that. But I now live in a one-bedroom apartment, and there's three of them. I think they were bringing their cousin, and they wanted to stay for 3 days. And I was like, oh, hell, I just picked this long hair, showers in my bathroom, and I was trying to get ready to leave for a week the same day they were leaving to go to Thailand. So it just didn't work out. I want to have quality time when they come.
Well, let me just tell you, they're not happy about it. Just so you know, those two junior little shits were not happy about it. And so I just told Peggy, I said, hey, the only thing I can tell you is kind of what I told you in 1996, and that is, if you do that, he wins, and our kids will be devastated, but
that's the thing.
They would understand.
Everyone would understand because it's a hard thing to live with. But I mean, when I was living in Indiana, I even planned it out. Planned it out. Suicide. Because I wouldn't want anyone to find me and be horrified.
Right.
And have to put someone else to that. But I had a plan out to go park my old car in a cornfield and blow my brains out. And it'd take them a long time to find me.
But
I cannot do that to people that I love. I know how it feels.
Right.
I couldn't do that to Mom or you, my nieces and nephews. We all lost Maureen, and now it's devastating to them. So, I just put my head down, and I decided there's one thing I have to do to, persevere in this life. You know, it seems like we're always looking for someone to love us, or to help us, or to comfort us. I had to love myself. I had to comfort myself. I had to heal my own wounds. I pray. I'm going to bring spirituality into this. I'm not going to bring religion into it. Spirituality. I highly believe in your own spirituality, whatever it is. If you like to say the rosary, if you like to read poetry, if you like to write in journals. But you have to be true to your heart and in belief in yourself. And I lost that. I mean, there's one thing that when I look back at pictures of us as adults, young adults, grown adults, there's always in the pictures a smile on my face and my mouth is open, I'm laughing, and I'm always having the best time dancing. He killed that Peggy. That Peggy's gone. I'll never be that the same. So
You're still a pretty good time though.
Well, yeah, well that's because I was extra outrageously fun before.
You were extra fun before, now you're just like normal fun?
Kinda.
All right. All right. So I want to talk about that spirituality because I want to talk about living because, you know, on this program, Peggy, I mean, you know, we talk about learning how to coexist with trauma because you're not getting over it. And I remember one of the things I said to Peggy that I was told, you know, I think the first time I really experienced death in the Marine Corps and that a helicopter crashed and I've told the story, but the co-pilot's decapitated, the co-pilot's crushed to death, two Marines are fighting for their lives, you're trying to help them live, doing everything you can, they're trying as hard as they can to live, you can tell, because their jugular veins are jumping out of their neck, because you know, so you know their body's dumping adrenaline, because their body doesn't know what's going on, but something's wrong, and you go through that dance of death, and I remember, you know, people say stupid shit to you in the aftermath. You know, and I remember telling Peggy, you know, people are going to tell you stupid shit, and none of it's true. God needed them more than you do. The hardest fire goes through the hottest steel, or the hardest steel goes through the hottest fire. There's a purpose in this. All that kind of bullshit.
Yeah, that just pisses you off.
Yeah, and I tell people, don't say shit like that. Just go up and give them a hug. If you don't know what to say, don't fill the gap with any bullshit. Like that, because it makes you angry when you hear people say that. And so coexisting. So talk about the aftermath, Peggy. Did you go to therapy? Did you find any peace there? Talk to us about learning to coexist with something that you know, we would all say is unimaginable.
Well, like I said, I went to therapy. I went to a lot of therapy. I never clicked with one. You know, they're sitting there saying you tap the pencil 10 times on your forehead and then tap it on your cheek and then take the pencil and poke your eyes out. That's what I wanted to say to that, you know, therapist, because it's unfathomable. It's unthinkable. I told people, I did it to a doctor one time, which was kind of mean to me, but you get angry. And so there was a while, I'd say in the 10 years, right after when I was still in Sacramento, where I got really mean. I was cussing people out and, you know, going off and having temper tantrums all the time because I was so angry and I needed to let that go. It's nobody's fault. Nobody, you know, can't do that to people. So what I did, you mentioned on the show one day, I kind of laughed. Could you turn me on to this guy, Cahill Gibran?
Yes.
Right?
Right.
He's a poet from what country? I don't even know.
He's a Lebanese poet.
Yep, and that book. What's that little book?
The Prophet.
The Prophet. Just reading through that book. Praying. We're Catholic. We were Catholic. Our whole lives, we know how to pray, we know how to go to church, but really it's just an introspective of looking into your own life and your own soul. And like I said, I have to love myself. I picture myself, you know, I remember when they go coffins going in the grave and I laid on top of them sobbing, and I picture myself, my spirit coming out of my body and reaching down and picking me up and giving myself a hug and holding myself close and say, we are going to, you know, I'm going to take care of you from now on. So it's just some people like to be creative. Some people are painters. Some people are music. But just an outlet for you to climb back into your soul and lift you up so you don't want to die every day.
So why did you stop going to therapy? Did you go to just individual therapy, group therapy? Did you try both? And it just, there was no answer in any of it for you?
Well, I didn't try that hard.
Right.
Basically, for the first year afterwards, I was seeing a psychiatrist. And they give you meds. I was taking all kinds of meds. I was taking anti-anxiety, antidepressants, tranquilizers. And I did that for a year. And then somebody came up to me, a friend of mine, and said, you know what? My mom, well, my brother died. He died very young. My mom went on all that those meds, and she's still on them, and that was 20 years ago. He goes, if you can, get off those, because you'll be stuck with them for the rest of your life. So I did. I flushed them. I stopped seeing the psychiatrist. And so then I moved on to different forms of therapy, and I'll say each one might have helped a little bit, but I've never done group therapy. It's like, okay, this is a segue, but as you know, I have Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this program, and it was developed in Indianapolis called Rocksteady Boxing. And the first time I went, I looked around at the other people there, and they were all had different, they had Parkinson's all at different stages. And some of them were really bad. Some of them were twitching, they couldn't walk normally, they were hunched. I just took a look around and I started to cry. I didn't want to be part of that group. I didn't want to be one of those people. I wanted to run out and say, this isn't me, but it was me. So I continued going, and by the time when I stopped going, it was because I was having problems with my legs swelling, but the last time I went, I remember walking out with tears in my eyes, being so proud to be a part of those people that were fighting back so hard against this progressive disease that there's no cure for, but you can fight back. That's the whole boxing thing, you know, it's exercise and punching a bag. So, back to the kids, I've never done group therapy. I've never tried it because I don't want to be one of those people that lost their children. So I've been hiding, but I think that's my next step in my, I'll call it recovery or just maintaining a happy life. I need to reach out and I need other people. I need to get in a group. I need to go back to weed. I need to give back.
Explain what WEAVE is to everybody. WEAVE is an organization in Sacramento called Women Escaping a Violent Environment.
Exactly. And you took the reins on that and right after the boys died and you started a fund. And you raised, what, $27,000?
No, it was like $87,000, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Anyway.
It was a lot of money.
Yeah, they got a lot of money, but I was so broken and so messed up. I never went to WEAVE. I never talked to them. I never met anybody there. I never even contacted them. We did it all, and then I just let it go because I didn't want to be. But it doesn't matter what I want. I am. And I think I have something to give back. I just,
yeah, but at the time, I don't think that you can do it. Before you're ready to, you know, what you're describing is with, you know, with the medicines and with therapy, I would tell you the majority of veterans do the exact same thing. They don't want to be on the zombie cocktail, right? They, you know, and they have their family members saying, I just want you to be the way you used to be. And they want to be the way you used to be, but you can't be that person anymore because you're not that person anymore. You've been changed by life has changed you. And it's frustrating because you really, I would love to be that person. You have no idea how bad I want to be that person, but I'm not that person anymore. And normally, because a lot of them don't identify with their therapists either, because we don't have enough combat veterans that are therapists, they stop going to therapy and they seek to find their own way. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of them don't. Right now the estimate is 20 a day. Don't find a reason to say no, and they take their own lives. And so that's why on this program, that's the whole purpose of All Marine Radio, is to help people learn to coexist with trauma. And so that's why I wanted to have you on today. That's why I wanted to talk about it with you. So in terms of, you don't get over it. You have to try to somehow or other learn to coexist with it. Now, and I will tell you, there's different techniques to coexist, and I'm just curious how you do it. You will hear a lot of Vietnam and World War II veterans say, stuff in the closet, shut the door, and never go near the door.
Just like, don't let the monkeys out of the cage.
That's right.
I learned that from you.
That's Durham.
I live by it because sometimes, you know, you toy around with those monkeys and you think, I can handle it. And you open the cage door and they all come out and turn into big, giant, killer gorillas. And you're on the floor screaming. Mm-hmm. That's not good either.
So you've tried to keep him in. You've tried to keep him in the cage, and don't go near him.
Well, here's the deal. I go near him. There's another. When you used to play that Rihanna song, "Friends with the Monsters Under My Bed."
Yeah.
I adapted that to my ways of thinking too. In other words, you know they're under there. You know they're monsters. But maybe you could peek under there and see what they're doing or see what they look like and become acquainted with them a little bit so they're not so scary. So, I guess it's the same as opening the cage and playing with the monkeys when they're in a good mood. You have to go there. You have to visit it. Otherwise, you know, the human mind can only live in denial for so long and then you're going to be overcome by it.
It's interesting. But again, it's Pandora's box, right? I mean,
of course it is. Because there's no words to describe those moments when you, like you said, when you're watching that progress and then it's your children laying on the floor. You know, what care? Why couldn't you shot me? Why couldn't I protect them that day? Why didn't I have a better plan? You know, that will never, ever go away. Sorry, my voice is getting scratchy because I'm crying. But, you know, you just got to love yourself. I've been very fortunate because I have a good family. I have mom and dad that love me, and I have brothers and sisters that love me. So everybody steps up, and everybody, you don't even know it, but they're helping you, they're carrying you. So I would say reach out, hold your family close. There's no sense in alienating anybody. But you can't run from it. You have to face it. You have to live with it.
Well, and as you know, I mean, before we came on the air, Paige was telling me that the latest episode was I was texting pictures of my daughters, a week ago or so? 2 weeks ago, maybe? I don't know.
August 18th.
And why
do I remember that day?
Why?
It was my youngest son's birthday.
Okay, and tell everybody what you thought.
Well, I'm just watching TV by myself, and my message pops up, and it's you sending Susan and I a picture of your girls, your beautiful girls. I thought, oh, that's nice. So then Susan pops up. I don't always respond to those texts either.
Right.
So Susan pops up and sends a picture of her three boys, which I knew she had to have just called them outside to sit on the step so she could take that picture. And then she sent it. And my first reaction was, oh, I wish I could send a picture of my kids. Oh, yeah, no, right, they're dead. and it just so happens to be Tyler's birthday. And I just put the phone down, and he said, well, you could have sent a picture of them, or you could have did this, or you could have did that. Well, it was just, I could have done a lot of things. I wanted to tie back and say, nice going, asshole. Tyler's birthday. Maybe way to make me feel good, but I didn't. Put the phone down and went to bed and cried myself to sleep. You're always going to have those days. Those days are never, ever, ever going to go away. You didn't know it was his birthday. Colleen just had a birthday. I didn't know it was her birthday. Susan told me. So it wasn't your fault, it wasn't anybody's fault, but you're going to, the rest of your life, you're going to have those moments where something's going to pop up unexpectedly and just bring it all back home, and it's like it just happened yesterday.
Now, let me ask you, because I describe it as having a menstrual cycle. For me, there's some days that I can think about things, and your boys are one of them. Merely the thought, I can feel the pressure behind my eyes, and I know that, I don't know where I am in my menstrual cycle, but I don't know if it's a heavy flow day, but it sure feels like it. But how do you describe that? Because you don't get over it. Your kids can't go away, right? There's so much
right.
woven into the fabric of your life, to this day. How do you deal with that? I mean, some days I've heard you talk about them, and then other days, not so much. Because again, there must be so many times that there's a memory of one of your sons triggered by something somebody does.
Well, for me, it's taken a long time, but when I think of them now, I had to change my way of thinking, of not thinking of that day, but thinking of happy memories, coming down to Thanksgiving at your house, looking at photo albums of my kids playing with your kids, running on the beach. Hold those close to you, because no one can take that away from you. And if anyone is wondering, I never remarried and got into another relationship. People actually said to me, well, you could have more kids. Well, I was 40 when this happened. I wasn't interested in replacing my kids. And I had a lot of suitors knocking on my door wanting to, a lot of men thinking they could rescue me. I did not need to be rescued. I was going to rescue myself. I had a good job. I kept my job. I guess part of it is stubbornness. But there's really no good answer I can give you for how do you do it. You just cope. Some of us get better coping skills than others. I had to get over the mean thing, because sometimes you want to lash out. One time I was at a doctor's office in Indiana, and I was really scared because I thought I had Parkinson's disease, which I ended up, yes, I did have it, but I didn't go to the doctor a lot, and I was really nervous. The new doctor, and you fill out the forms in the waiting room, and it was a female doctor, and it says marital status. Now, you could put single or you could put widow. Why did I put widow? That's what I checked. So she comes in our room, and I'm sitting there, and she's like, first of all, I just want to tell you how sorry I am about your husband. I looked at her. I did not feel good. I was shaking. My back hurt. I knew there was something wrong with me. And I said, oh, well, don't be, because he shot both my kids in the head and killed himself, so don't be sorry for that. She had to leave the room. She was so, and that was so mean of me. I should never have done that, but I was angry. And that was a stupid thing for her to say.
Right. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. I mean, it was something that she would say to anybody, right? I mean, how could she know?
Well, she didn't know, but she found out. And I should have just said, oh, thanks.
Right.
Those are things, daily struggles that, you know. Or so, like when I lived in Indiana, I worked there. I had a job in a law office for 10 years. I never told one single person about my boys or my marriage or any of that.
Well, that's in keeping with, right, leave the monkeys in the cage, right? I mean, you were doing that.
In an office situation in a group.
Right.
You know, women are mean. They were mean to me just because I was a new girl. And here I was from California. I was 50 years old. I was like all friendly. Hi. They were so mean to me just because, and I thought, oh, God. If I confided that in someone in this office, it would be like wildfire, and I'd have to go through it all over again. So, it's partially, that was why I came back to Sacramento, one of the reasons I wanted to be me again. Everybody here that knows me knows what happened.
Right. Peggy is a bit of a legend in Sacramento, just so you know.
Because I win dance contests.
My older sister Peggy joins us today. We're talking about her life. We're talking about living with trauma and Peggy, a domestic violence incident. Her husband shot and killed their two sons, who were 4 and 6 years old, Torian and Tyler, and then took his own life. After he beat Peggy because she said she was leaving. When I say things like, you know, when you have days like that, you know, you have to be gentle with yourself. Does that make sense to you?
Exactly. That's why I said you have to love yourself. I pictured visually in my head, my mind, me coming to the alive and well, Peggy coming to the broken Peggy and just holding her in her arms and saying it's going to be okay. You have to be gentle with yourself.
Knowing that you're going to have these ups and downs, and that's just part of the normal, being normal, living with trauma.
Yep, because it's never, ever going to go away. So therapy is good. I'm going to try group therapy here soon, because if I can help anyone else, this is the first time I've done this, spoken out loud about it, even on screen in my living room, talking to my brother.
We've never even discussed this.
No. Because it's hard. It's opening up the cage. It's like a wound, you know, you got a big gnarly wound and you put a bandage on it, gauze, and it seems like it's getting better and you're walking around, you're feeling better, but then you got to peel it back and look at it and it's like, oh, still a mess. Healing is a long time, takes a long time. And so just to get the record straight, I will never, ever be the same. There's no answer to, oh, just get back to normal and live your life. It changed my life forever, and as it should, those are my children. But I could never, I don't think about killing myself anymore because I'm 62 years old, and I've made it this far. I have a lot of people that love me. I can't do that. I can't cause any more hurt or pain on this planet.
Okay, well, and one of the reasons why we're doing this is, as I've learned more and more about dealing with trauma, and I talk to people every week about it, one of the experiences I've had that made me think of Peggy was different people have contacted me and said, you know, I started listening to your program, and it's made a huge difference in my life. Luke, who was on the program, his mom emails me and says, you don't know me, but she starts talking about the change in him and she could never say thank you enough to me. You know, and again, I say that for me, on those days, your heart, right, does what the Grinch's heart does when he hears the Who people sing, right? It grows. It's this wonderful feeling like there's nothing I can do about what happened, but I can try to use it to the good, and if that helps somebody, then honestly, it impacts me in a positive way. And then, so I had experiences with Luke and his mom, then with Luke's girlfriend, and because one of the things I said was that, you know what, we, us military guys, I mean, we signed up for what we did, you know, we went and experienced what we experienced, and there's a whole lot of people that don't sign up for anything. Peggy didn't sign up for anything, right? She got yanked into the pool of this shit, you know? And so realizing that there's so many more people out there that are affected by trauma, and if you get your shit together and you can help other people, you help yourself. It is the most wonderful feeling. And so Emma, you know, I met Emma, Luke's girlfriend, Luke's fiance, and she talked about, you know, a traumatic event in her life. And she's talked about how they can relate to each other. And I felt so good that when in our discussion that Mike and I had with them, we didn't talk solely about the military. We talked about everybody who had trauma, which would include her. I had another girl who's a country music singer. Her name's Peyton Davis, and her father committed suicide when she was a junior in high school. And she was the one who found him, or had the police come over and was there when they found him, blah, 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 blah. And she starts saying things like learning how to coexist with it, knowing that I'm never going to get over it. And she said, I started listening because my Uncle Kurt told me that I should listen. And so she talked about, when I said, you know, Peyton, you're part of our tribe, she said, you don't know this, but I just got the biggest smile on my face. And I thought, you know what, my sister doesn't feel any of that. And so she needs to tell her story so that she could help other people. And slowly but surely, those things happen where they trickle in. And I think listening to you may have saved my life, may have saved my kid's life, may have saved my daughter's life, whatever. And I thought, and that's what I called Peggy. And I said, hey, you need to come on my show. After we talked about it, hey, you know, not like that, but hey, you need to come on. I know, I'm not ready, or blah, 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 blah. And so last week when I called her, I said, you need to do this because you need to experience the good feeling, because you've lived for 22 years with the bad feelings. And so,
yeah.
And I think by telling your story, you begin to do that, because there's nothing you can do about the past. And there's Marines that live with decisions they made that got other people killed, that if it happened again today, they'd do the exact same thing and they would have to live with it. They wouldn't do anything different. The guy who talks about the monkeys, he won the award, one down from the Medal of Honor. He killed in a firefight, he and his Marines, I think there was 8 of them, killed 24 insurgents, which meant there was probably close to 100 of them there, if that many got killed. But he lost 3 of his own Marines. And all he does is blame himself. All he used to do was blame himself for those 3 deaths. And he struggled and wanted to kill himself and went down that road. And so it's not an easy place. But when you begin to help people, I think it changes you. I think it changes you. And so that's one of the reasons we're doing this today. I have a couple.
Well,
go ahead.
I just wanted to mention one thing that I was listening to your show one day. This was months ago, but Gunnar was talking about who's that little gal that got kidnapped from her own bedroom. And she was with that weird guy, and they were
The girl from Salt Lake City. That's an awesome movie. If you've never seen it,
Gunnar was talking, and I was listening, and his words, I had to sit down in my bedroom and just put my head down and cry, and it was good tears, because his awe of this girl and the book she wrote and this movie was so, and this is a Marine. You know, I never met Mike, but, you know, he's fought in battle, I'm sure, and it just really touched me that a woman was being compared to one of the Marines that protected us in our country. It feels good.
Yeah, it's a story. It's a story of Elizabeth Smart.
Elizabeth Smart, yes.
And if you haven't seen it, and you want to know, and she produced it. She produced it as she's a mother now, and she's married and has a guy, and they live in Scotland, and so she produced this movie, and I'm looking for the name of it, but if you can see it, you should see it. It is absolutely it's an absolutely inspiring movie about her. And she talks about fighting to regain your life. And that's one of the things, and Peggy's talked about it. You know, your life's not going to be the same. It's going to be different. But you can still live. I think it's called the Elizabeth Smart story. I would love to. I've emailed her foundation to get her to come on. I haven't heard back from them. Hopefully someday she will. But it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And she talks about, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, right? Sometimes life does these things to you, but it doesn't mean that you can't live a great life. And so, and it's a great, great film.
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
I just no. You but need? I'm going to look for it.
Yeah.
Today. On my TV.
All right, you need to. I want a couple, Peggy, a couple more questions. Alcohol. You're no.
Alcohol is not your friend.
You're no stranger to a good time. And so talk to me about alcohol and drugs and living with post-traumatic stress.
They're your worst enemy. And I like to party. I grew up, I was graduating high school in 1974. I lived through the disco era in the 80s and all that. But what it does, drugs and alcohol, is they make your mind weak. And they make you vulnerable. They make you lose your reasoning. And they'll destroy you. You want someone to let the monkeys out of the cage, go ahead and drink a half a bottle of tequila and start thinking about your problems. The monkeys will destroy you. And we know we lost a sister to alcoholism. And she never had any traumas or major events like that in her life, but it's a disease, and it doesn't help anything. Anything. It might make you feel better for 5 or 10 minutes, but it's your worst nightmare.
I want to ask you another question. After Tori and Tyler were killed, and I have a copy of it. I might even have, I think I have the original. I haven't given it back to you yet. I have
the letter.
The letter. Can you hold on 1 second? Do you care if I read part of the letter?
No.
Because I want to talk about this letter and hope and what it means when somebody extends their hand to you. So give me, give me 1 second. I heard about this letter. How long after the boards were killed did you get this letter, Peggy? It wasn't very long, was it?
Weeks. It was weeks. It was pretty quickly.
Okay. So I'm going to... the lady who wrote this, her name is Stella. Dear Peggy and family, you and your family don't know me, but feel very close, but I feel very close to you at this moment. This is written on binder paper, okay, by hand. I read about what happened to you and your family. I know there is nothing anyone can say or do to make things better. This I know because 11 years ago, I lived your tragedy and pain. My husband shattered my world the same way yours did. It was like reading my story all over again. My beautiful boys were 3 and 6, Lawrence and Adam. My heart goes out to you and your family. I am not sure why I am writing you. I guess I just want to say you are not alone in your pain. One thing that helped me survive is the love and support of my family and friends. Let them carry you through this, and remember, all you need to do now is to get past one day at a time, 1 minute at a time. Don't worry about all the tomorrows. Just get past today, this hour. I can't tell you the pain will go away, because it won't. But the day will come, and this is the part that I've never forgotten about this letter. I can't tell you the pain will go away, because it won't. But the day will come that it won't hurt so bad. This I promise you. You will also know and feel your boys with you forever. And I know, and no one can take that from you. Please don't throw my address away. Just put it aside at this moment. It can't comfort you at all. But after the shock is gone and people stop calling and coming by, when it seems like the world has continued as if nothing has changed, and then in parentheses she writes, I think this is one of the most difficult things to accept. The fact that the world has not changed and continues, but you and your life have changed permanently. It's at these times I wish I had someone who knew exactly what I was feeling. It may not be now, but years from now, that you want someone to talk to. I will always live in Los Banos, California, and have a listed number, so no matter how much time goes by, if you want to talk, please call. I have enclosed a few photos. They gave me no comfort at first, but now they are of great comfort. Poems. One was written by my brother about the pain my brother and family felt at this time. And then she signs it, yours in sadness, Stella. And to me, I remember when Peggy told me about this letter, to me, the thing it did was it gave Peggy hope. That here's somebody who had been through something similar and that stuck her hand out, and then from that is something that nobody else can give you other than somebody else who's been through what you've been through. And for Peggy, that's not very many people. And that this person stuck her hand out. When I think of a helping hand, I think of, like, I believe it's on the Sistine Chapel, the hand of God that reaches out, right? That's the hand that right. I have in my brain. This hand that reaches out to you that says, it's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be the way it is, but there will come a day when you will think of your sons and not think of the way they died, but you'll think of the way they lived. And you talked about that a little bit ago. But that letter and people extending themselves, talk about what that meant.
Well, that helped me. I kind of patterned what she told me about making it from day to day, minute to minute. That was the best advice anyone ever gave me. And knowing that there was someone else, I mean, her words just, they floored me. And so I kept the letter. I think I wrote her back just thanking her and saying I'd be in touch, and then didn't keep in touch. But yet it happened a few years later to a gal in the Bay Area. But her husband, it was a standoff with the police, and he had the two little girls in the house with him. And he killed himself and he killed his little daughters, and I wrote her a letter. And it's hard to get to the person because, you know, they're kind of protected. So I just gave it to the police chaplain here in Sacramento and asked if they could get it to her. I don't know if she ever got it, but I never heard from her. But that's the kind of stuff that letter kept me alive.
So if people think about...
We gotta find her.
I looked her up. She's listed. You can. I don't think her phone number is listed, but her address is. So we can find her. I already found her. Advice if anybody out there that is impacted by trauma, and it may be horrible divorces, right? It may be people listening may be affected by combat post-traumatic stress, but it really doesn't matter, in my opinion, to stick your hand out and say, hey, I'm here for you, right? And to speak the truth, it's not going to go away, but you'll learn to coexist with it. You're going to have hard days. Be gentle with yourself, right? If you're a drinker, you're going to have to stop. And I think all those things resonate, Peggy, because they're the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, the drinking and drugs, they're not going to help you. I mean, there's certain drugs that we doctors give us to help us cope when we need to cope, when we can't at the beginning, but those aren't going to help you get better. They're just going to numb you out emotionally.
No, that's that whole zombie cocktail. And you know what? There might be people. I was interviewing a woman last week, and this is my own opinion. I think that 90% of the Marines that go to the VA and get the zombie cocktail and get told to go to group and go to therapy, I don't think that's what they need. I don't think they need that. I think it was really cool. The woman who I interviewed said, look, she said, Mac, you guys are the most incredible group of people I've ever been around. You guys are warriors, man. You've gone through all that training. You're disciplined. You have leadership in you. You're brave. You know, you're fearless in the face of danger. And now we're going to sell you that you're broken and you're dysfunctional and you're disabled for life. She says, that's ridiculous. You just need training on how to deal with your new life. And to me, that made so much sense because we train. We go through training. I mean, hell, you became a court reporter. So I know how to do that. And if you'll show me, I bet I can do it. And if you'll put me in with other people that will support me like I've been used to in my life, I know I can do it. I know I can do it. It's just really cool. And I guess the reason I read the letter is to people that are out there, don't be afraid to extend yourself to other people, because there's a lot of people that have been affected by trauma. They're all over the place.
Well, you know what I did probably the first year is I had received so many cards and letters from loved ones, family members, coworkers, but I also received letters from to say. Like this one started out, you don't know who I am, but. And so I just recently read a lot of them. And I made an album, like a photo album. And I put all these letters and cards and pictures from little first graders in Charlie's class. And they drew a picture of him going to heaven. And I kept those. Sorry. But it's healing to go through that stuff and read it again. Read it. One of the majority of court reporters are women. I don't know why. Because it's probably because it's so hard. Men couldn't do it. But
no, it's girl work. It's girl work. It's not hard. It's just girl stuff.
There were several men court reporters, and one guy, he was married. Nicest guy ever. Tom Hennessy. Sorry. He wrote me this card. This. I can pull it out right now and read it. I couldn't read it because it makes me feel it's uplifting. It's such a good feeling to know that someone else, you know, he just said, Peggy, if I could take away your pain for 1 minute, I would crawl through the desert on broken glass, you know. You were such a wonderful mother and so, you know, you had beautiful children. And to reread those, or the ones that you say, you don't know me, but I read about you, your story in the paper, is very, very uplifting. And it's emotional because the fact that people really do reach out and people really do care. You're not alone, no matter how bad you feel. There's people out there.
But you feel alone. Yes, you feel. I mean,
yes.
Right. But the truth is, you're not. And I guess you talked about trying to, you know, deal with your anger so that you could let other people in and not
exactly.
Push
exactly
not push me away.
You know, and it was really hard when my kids passed away. A lot of my friends and cousins had kids the same age, and I was mad. I couldn't go around them when it was birthdays and Christmas. I stayed by myself. I had a lot of invitations, but I stayed home alone because it was too hard watching them with their kids. And now that everybody's grown up, gone to college, out of the house, and now my friends are becoming grandmothers. And some days I sit up here by myself on a Sunday afternoon thinking, I wish I had some grandkids, or I wish my kids would come by. It's just always going to be there.
Right. Well, Colleen and I came up and spent Christmas, and I got you a Swiffer, and you threw it against the wall. That was pretty nice.
Yeah. That's never mind.
Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. What'd you tell me the last time I was up there? What's the favorite thing you have in your car now?
Well, because it was on my car, but I had just moved into this really cute apartment and had it all fixed up and had a cleaning person come. A friend of mine's niece came and just cleaned it. Everything was shining and polished and pretty. And so I opened this Christmas present and he gives me a damn Swiffer. I go, Jesus Christ, there's no dust in the house. He goes, it's for your car.
She threw it against the wall. She said, what the fuck is this? Colleen almost pissed her pants. And I said, it's for your car, you dumbass. She's like, I don't want a Swiffer. What is wrong with you? I said, I wasn't even gonna get it for you, but I got my cell phone. I figured I'd get you one as I was walking out of the store. Nice.
You're lucky I didn't bounce it off your head.
Let me tell you, Colleen thought that was the funniest thing she'd ever seen in her life. She's like, oh, my God, Dad. Aunt Peggy is so funny. I said, she's not funny. Like, I'm funny.
That was funny.
Tommy's funny. Peggy's not very funny. She's like, no, Dad, you're wrong. Peggy's funny. I'm like, yeah. She's funny.
It was funny.
All right, let me ask you one more question.
All right.
Actually, two more. One, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want people to know either about what happened to you, domestic violence, living with trauma, anything? What haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want to?
Well, it's not that you're not smart enough to ask me, and I don't know if this will even reach the audience that it should, because probably not many young girls, and it doesn't matter how young or how old, if you are in a relationship where you are in the least bit intimidated, frightened, or apprehensive of someone you're dating or going out with or living with or married to, run. There's so many resources out there. There's so many people. We all have our little phones. You could plug in, you know, type in anything. Help for domestic violence. Reach out. It could be a matter of life or death, because I never, ever in a million years thought that would happen to me. Never, ever. So prevention is the best way to do it. And so I have not been in a relationship or gotten remarried, and it's with purpose. I wasn't very good at picking good guys. I'm not saying my husband wasn't a good guy, but he has problems, and I just am not very good at relationships. So I made a decision that I'm gonna be by myself the rest of my life. But that's okay. So anyway, I would just say, you know, don't let people bully you. Don't let people scare you. Stand up, be heard, and get the hell out of there.
And I think you're right. I mean, since 1996, there's, from what you see on TV to, you know, to as you said, everybody's got a phone now. And but the bottom, I, you know, again, I never, I mean, we're you know, upper middle class white family. I mean, domestic violence wasn't supposed to touch our lives, was it? Well, the truth is,
nope.
Domestic violence cuts through every ethnic group.
Walk of life.
It cuts through every economic group. It cuts through every cultural group.
And it goes both ways. I've known situations with people I know where I felt like the man was very abused. Verbally, sometimes physically, mentally. So it's not just women. I'm a woman and we're speaking out today to other women in domestic violence, but it affects all people.
All right. My big sister, Peggy. All right. Anything else that is on your mind today?
Oh, no, not much, except for one more thing. To all the ladies out there, whatever trauma or whatever thing you're going through, if you're like my brother, if you're on your menstrual cycle, one thing that will help, always, are mani-pedis. Don't get a manicure or a pedicure, because it just makes, like, that's what I'm going to go do right now. I'm going to go get a pedicure.
What?
Get my feet.
I don't think men should get manicures and pedicures. I don't like that.
Well, I was speaking to the women, but
okay. All right.
Also speaking as a woman, you know, men's feet can be really gross
they
at
are.
Times.
Yeah, like why would I make some small Asian woman like work on my feet? That's disgusting. Yeah.
Okay, Matt, we're going to...
it's the truth. That's why I don't go. Like, Catherine and Colleen want me. Dad, you should go. I'm like, come on, man.
You
like,
should go. That's what I'm going to give you for your birthday.
What do I want? Like, some Asian woman to have nightmares about my feet at night? Come on. I'm a nice
Asian. Your feet aren't bad.
Yeah, they are. Come on. They're not girl feet. Girl feet are different, you know? Men feet are disgusting. So, anyway. Anyway,
just think about it next time you want to rub your foot on someone's soft, creamy calf.
Yeah. No, I'll fall. No, I'll use my shoe. Right? I'll use my shoe. All right. My older sister, Peggy, by about 15 months. And first time we've ever done this. Peggy, thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
All right. Very proud of you.
Thank you. I love you.
All right. There you have it. My big sister. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. So there you have it. Let me give you some thoughts on that. That's, I've been getting emails throughout the interview, and I would echo what everybody says in their emails, and that is... That's rough stuff. This one's entitled Peggy. Good morning, Mac. I intend on listening to your interview with your sister, Peggy. It's going to be heartbreaking but necessary. I wish my advice to many women I've encountered of domestic violence would have left their husbands or boyfriend after I arrested them for beating them, many not for the first time. But many got back together and the violence continued. It's an ugly, ugly way of life, and the children unfortunately see this shit and they carry it with them for a long time. Anyway, I don't want to hijack your show, but perhaps Peggy's message will help some who listen, that they can leave and help themselves and their children. I have no clue how Peggy carries on after such a traumatic event. What a strong, strong woman. Thank you to Peggy and to you for the interview. Vacaville, man. I wrote some stuff down, and so let me just give you some thoughts based on the last 24 hours of kind of dealing with this in a way that I don't deal with it often. The first thing is relative to the email. Domestic violence is a hard issue, right? When you talk about it notionally, what's the thing you hear all the time? If he ever raised his hand to me, I'd be out of there so fast and make your head spin. I would never. Then why do 90% of women, if you look at statistics, the overwhelming majority of women stay, the overwhelming majority of men stay in that situation? Why? Because it's not black and white. The person who's doing that is the same picture that's in the wedding picture. He or she is in the same picture that when we had the baby, holding the baby together. So why do they stay? And the other thing is that everybody deals with this for the first time. Most, unless people stay, and it happens repeatedly. But just about everybody's dealing with this, trying to deal with this for the first time. It's not easy. And I've learned not to judge anybody, because it's hard. You know, Peggy talks about not wanting people to know your business, you know, you know, all these different feelings you have inside of you, thinking you can handle it and whatnot. So anyway, I thought I'd throw that out. The part that she said that I said to her, she doesn't recall our conversation, but she recalls one piece of it, which is really interesting. I spoke with her at the police station, which was the first time I said those things to her. I don't even think she recalls that conversation. The second conversation we had, and I was upset. But, you know, I think one of the things in the Marine Corps, you know, especially as a leader, you don't communicate that. And so, but it was eerie in doing the interview. She recites almost verbatim what I told her that day. And when I was listening to it, when she said it, I sat here thinking, oh my God, that's almost verbatim what I said to her that day. It's a pretty amazing. Things that I'll tell you that just as in the course of the last 24 hours, things that have come into my head as I've worked on this. I said before the interview started that my dad was managing the California Angels, the baseball team. And so the story, when it hit, I remember talking to my ex-wife, Susan, and her saying, well, we don't have to tell the boys. And then she called me back later. She said, I just got a call from my brother who was up and said going to UC Santa Barbara. He called. And initially, right, there was people that checked in with me because it said, you know, the grandsons of John McNamara, where I had two sons. And people weren't sure if it wasn't me. And so my phone started blowing up. And my email started blowing up. Hey, man, what's going on? I'm like, no, it's not. It's my sister. Like, oh, shit, man. My heart stopped. So when I spoke to my wife, she said, we have to tell the boys. And so John was home. And Patrick was playing at a friend's house. And I remember I came home from work. I was going to go get a haircut. And I said to John, I said, hey, you want to go with me to get a haircut? And he said, no. And I said, okay, well, get in the car. So he gets off the couch and, you know, John's 9, I think, at the time. Patrick was 6. And, you know, we get in the car. We're pulling out of the driveway. And he looks at me and says, am I in trouble? And I said, no, you're not in trouble. And so we go to get Patrick. Now, Patrick had hockey practice later that day. And so he was at his buddy's house, a kid by the name of Matt. He's at Matt's house. And he and Matt are like inseparable friends. They play hockey together. They go to school together. Pat, as I pull up in front of the house, Patrick comes running around the corner. And he freezes when he sees me. And he says, Dad, Mom, Matt's mom's taking us to hockey practice. And I said, no, you need to come with me. And he looks at me, and I said, right now. Now, Patrick knows me well enough, right? He's like, he's serious? And he comes and gets in the car. And So now we're driving down the hill, headed for the barbershop. And it's like I had talked to people involved in domestic violence in Sacramento that day to ask them, what do I do? How do I do this? What do I tell my kids? Because I've got to tell them because it's on the news. Their friends' parents are going to talk about it. Their friends will probably hear it. And if I don't tell my kids, what are they going to hear it like at hockey practice or at school? So so anyway, we're driving down the hill. And what they told me was you have to create a disconnect between a father's anger and what happened today. And I said, well, how do I do it? What do I say? And they said, only you know that. You know your kids. You'll figure it out. And I was like, okay. And so we're in a Honda Accord. John had hopped in the back seat, and Patrick's in the front seat. He's not tall enough. His feet don't touch the floor yet, right? So he's sitting in the seat. His seat's are sticking straight out. He's a little guy. And I remember thinking, well, here we go. And I said, today something really bad happened. And they both, you know, they didn't say a word. They just looked at me. And I said, Tori and Tyler were killed today. And they... they both looked at me. And again, my kids are little, right? I mean, they don't know shit. And so John's in the back seat, and he says, did they get killed in a car accident? And I said, no. Their dad killed him with a pistol. And Patrick, all of 6 years old, looks at me from the passenger seat, and he says almost exactly what these people told me that one of my kids would say. Dad, My menstrual cycle's killing me today. Why would a dad kill their kid with a gun? 6 years old. And I said, sometimes people go crazy. And he wasn't being their dad. He was crazy. And crazy people do crazy things. But they're with God now. And nobody can ever hurt them again. And so that was like the first, so that was that afternoon that the wreckage of this, not confined to, you know, to that house, to Peggy, you know, it affects a lot of people. At the funeral home, just different snapshots that have bounced into my head. At the funeral home, we're Catholic, so we do the rosary, right? Which is essentially the viewing and whatnot. And so we get there, and before everybody showed up, whenever the rosary was going to be, Peggy was going to say goodbye to her sons, and then we're going to get that out of the way. So my dad and I are on either side of Peggy as we go to take her down to do this. And So the building's kind of like, the room's kind of like an L-shaped room with chairs, right? So you walk in from a foyer, and then you turn right, and then there the two caskets are. The first thing that struck me when we turned, when we got into the room was the size of the caskets. They're small, small white caskets. And then being physically connected to my sister, you know, I could feel her breathing, right? I could feel her gasping for air. And you know the sounds that you hear people make when they're grief-stricken? I mean, they're not normal sounds. It's like it's something that comes from their soul. So, you know, so that whole thing's going on. We get to the caskets, and she lays down, and I'm standing on her right. She kneels down in front of her youngest son's casket, and he had a baseball hat on. He had an Angels baseball hat on because of the damage done to his head. And he had a coat and tie and on, and he had his hands crossed at his sternum. And she touched him. And when she touched him, her hand shot back from his hand. And I looked at her and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "He's cold. Will you go find me a blanket?" And I said, "Yes." So I went to the funeral director and I said, "I need 2 blankets. And he kind of looked at me and he said, "You know," I said, "the boys are cold." And he found me 2 blankets. He found me 2 blankets. And I took them to Peggy. And then watched her tuck her sons in for the last time as she apologized to him. And she kept saying over and over, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." At the funeral, this actually is somewhat sad and funny at the same time because of her reaction, but the funeral's at a church called St. Francis in Sacramento. It was the church my dad went to growing up, and the church of, if our family has a church, it's St. Francis in downtown Sacramento. We're in the foyer of the church with the two caskets. I'm standing behind Peggy, my sister Susan on one side, my wife Susan on the other side. I'm standing behind Peggy in case she faints. My mom and dad, the first time they'd acted as parents, which kind of we all kind of made a comment about. Our parents had a divorce that was akin to the Germans leaving Russia, right? They burned everything down. They annihilated our family. They never spoke again. This is the only time, I think, one of maybe 2 times I ever spoke after they separated in 1991. So they were acting like parents, and so they're on either side of my sister. The Franciscan priest starts. Today we commend the souls of something like this, of our beautiful sons, Toby and Tyler. And he continued. And I, my head, like, raised, and I looked at my wife, and I said, "Did he say Toby?" She said, "I think so, but I'm not sure," because everybody's numb, right? Like I'm listening to what he's saying. And I looked at my sister, and I said, "Did he say Toby?" And she says, "I wasn't listening." And so he keeps going, and then he says something like, "And as we celebrate the lives of Toby and Tyler," and with that Peggy says, I don't know, the 2,000, 3,000 people in this church, Peggy looks at him and says in a loud voice, "It's Tory, motherfucker." I remember, you know, that guy, I mean, how horrible he felt. But, I mean, you got to be kidding me. How did he screw that one up? So, I remember sitting in church and thinking to myself, you know what, for the rest of my life, as often as I can, I will tell their story so that their story saves as many lives as it possibly can. And I have, and it has. And I hope my sister gets to feel that too. I'll never forget Jim Rome. I called, I'm like, what do you do? And so all these people were interested in like, well, what can we do to help? And so we started a fund. Peggy talked about it during the interview, but, and I'm not sure how much money it raised now that I think about it, but I think it was upwards of $50,000-$70,000. I'm not sure. And we donated it to an organization in Sacramento, called WEAVE, which is Women Escaping a Violent Environment. I went out there and visited that place. I should tell that story. A couple years later, you know, and this is really my introduction to domestic violence. I didn't know anything about domestic violence. You know, so I went out and I met these people, you know, who we were going to give this money to, and they gave me this tour of their secure facility. You know, it's a hide place, essentially. And so we were walking down a hall, I in a suit, two women, and, you know, just in business attire. And it was a pretty wide hallway, and this little, he was black, this little kid, he probably was 5 or 6 years old, he comes running around the corner, and he sees them, and they stick their hand out, and he gives them five, right? So I stick my hand out, and he sees me, and he moves to the other side of the hallway, and he keeps going. And I said, because I'm a stranger? And she says, no, because you're a man. It's kind of my first dealing with it, with domestic violence. We went around the corner, and there was a woman in a classic mom pose, right? She's got two kids. One's on her hip, right? So she's got her hip kind of shoved out, kid sitting on her hip. And she's in this kitchen area, and she's fixing them something to eat. And the other kid, like, holding onto her skirt. Mom, when's lunch going to be ready or whatever? And I remember they took me up and they said, hey, Jenny, we want you to meet Mike. He's a friend. And we're just kind of showing him around. And she turns around and she had her left cheek was completely caved in. And all the teeth in her upper palate, starting from the center, going around to that left side, were gone. And she says, I know I look terrible. I said, you look great. I said, it's nice to meet you. But that was my introduction to domestic violence. And one of the things it taught me was, you know, this isn't, domestic violence, it isn't, you know, men slapping women. That's not what we're talking about. The problem's incredibly worse than that. A couple years later, my dad was honored by my high school that has this big organization that celebrates baseball. And they inducted him into their Hall of Fame. My sons were too young when my dad was in Major League Baseball, so I thought, well, this will be cool to go to. So we went up. We stayed at Peggy's house, a different house than her sons were killed in. But, I mean, their pictures and stuff is all over the house, right? So we're up there for this dinner, and we're hanging out. And as I'm watching my sons, I can see them lingering on pictures, and, like, I can see the gears moving in their heads. And I'm not sure which one came up to me and said this, but they said, could we go to the cemetery and see them? And I said, yes, of course. So I said, ask Aunt Peggy if she wants to go. Peggy said, no, I don't want to go, but will you take flowers from my garden to put on their graves? And we said, sure. So John and Patrick, now maybe 10 and 7, something like that. They went out and they cut flowers with Peggy. So we have a bunch of flowers. So John and Patrick, me and my dad, we go to the cemetery where they're buried. My grandmother's buried there. My grandfather buried there. My a great uncle buried there. So anyway, so we go to put the flowers on their graves. Brutal, right? First time I'd ever seen their little white tombstones that they have. And we're sitting there, and you know, you're again futile, but you try. You know, the thought goes through your head, it's not gonna be easy, gotta be tough. But I don't know. I mean, God certainly hasn't granted me that kind of toughness. When you see your kids, dealing with, death, certainly the way that they shouldn't have to deal with it. As we're walking back to the car, my dad was walking next to Patrick, and I think had his hand on Patrick's shoulder. And I put my arm around John, and we were walking, and he looked at me, and he said, "Do you think it hurt?" And I lied to him, right? I said, "They were asleep, John. And the next second, they were with God." The other parts of this story, my cousin's husband, Peggy mentioned, is a police officer. His name's Joe, and he's been on the program before, talking about PTSD. Anyway, Joe responded. He was a canine. He's a canine unit, right? So Joe essentially, to use military terms, he supports the whole city with his dog, right? He goes anywhere. As opposed to, if you and I are in a squad car and we're on patrol, we have a certain area of operations, right? Joe, because of the unique capability of him, of the dog, he supports everybody. So he hears shots fired on the street Peggy lived on. So he heads over there. He gets there, and they have Peggy's husband in the back of the car. There was a prowler in their backyard or something, and he shot at him with his pistol, so they were going to arrest him for discharging a firearm within city limits. Peggy begs him, to intercede so her husband's not arrested. He does. And in the process, they don't confiscate his weapon. The morning that the boys were killed, Joe responds he's in bed. He's told me the story. And his phone starts blowing up, and he gets told, "Hey, you need to get down here." He hears about it. So he goes to the house, and so he sees what's there, and he sees the gun that he gave back to him. And he's struggled incredibly since then. And now he goes and he talks to police academy classes, sheriff's academy classes, law enforcement classes, and talks about keep your honor clean, do the right thing. And he blames himself. Before I went to Afghanistan, I'd never been to the house where it happened. I said, "Would you take me over there and just show me?" And he said, "It's hard, but yeah, of course." So he and I headed over there, and Patrick said, "Could I go?" And I said, "Yeah, it's not going to be easy, though." And he said, "I know." So we go there, and Joe explains to me what happened that morning. And he looks at me, and he says, "I blame myself for what happened." He said, "If I would have confiscated that gun, and we could have let him go, I just would have taken his weapon. That might have never happened." And I looked at him and I said, "Joe, do you think if you took his weapon that he wouldn't have got another one?" And he looked at me and said, I appreciate you saying that, and I know what you're saying. If you were me, what would you feel? I said, I'd feel what you feel. And so, as I said, this thing kind of reverberates, right, through your family. Which one thing about what's interesting about the interview is Peggy's story is so similar to veterans in that she's prescribed all the same medications, right? Therapy doesn't work for her, so what does she do? She throws the drugs away. She stops going to therapy, and she stuffs it in the closet. In her case, very similar to veterans, she self-medicates. She goes through a phase where with alcohol and drugs that she self-medicates. And my younger sister, Susan, I think saved Peggy's life when she said, come back. You need to leave here. You need to come back to Indiana. The last comment I'll make, and then we're going to take a quick break, and then Mike's going to join us. The Gunner's going to join us. That letter that lady named Stella wrote, and I've reached out to Stella. I haven't heard back from her, but I will track Stella down. That equals hope, okay? That equals hope. And I think my own opinion is when we as veterans, when we as combat veterans can get our shit together and then preach the gospel of coexisting with trauma, you are giving people hope, right? Your life's going to be different, but you can live a good life. You can live a great life. But it is going to be different. And anybody who's telling you that it's not is full of shit. When they hear that, in my opinion, that's the letter. That's the letter. You're giving them hope. And that hope changes lives. That hope sustained my sister. So to Stella, wherever you are, it's awesome. So we'll take a quick break. Mike Musselman's going to join us. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nelson. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Yeah, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.